From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, rebuilding the Baghdad Zoo and trying to rescue the animals. We talk with Stefan Bognar of the group Wild Aid about the nearly 2 months he spent in Baghdad. The zoo had been a battle zone. Most of the zoo's 600 animals were gone when he got there, consumed for food, sold on the black market, or taken as exotic pets. Also, we talk with jazz pianist and singer Barbara Carroll. The 78-year-old performer recently received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Kennedy Center. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Steel Guitar Jazz, the reissue of a 1963 album by Buddy Emmons. And linguist Jeff Nunberg talks about the modern fixation with acronyms like SUV for sports utility vehicle. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush is defending his decision to go to war against Iraq, and the president said he's convinced that Iraq's weapons program will eventually be uncovered. His comments came amid charges that the Bush administration manipulated intelligence reports to support its insistence that Iraq was an imminent threat to Americans. Critics have said the U.S. failure to find weapons of mass destruction has hurt American credibility.
Credibility of this country is based upon our strong desire to make the world more peaceful, and the world is now more peaceful after our decision.
Democrats in Congress have called for an investigation of the administration's use of intelligence in determining whether to go to war against Iraq. A spokesman for Jewish settlers says Israeli troops have begun dismantling a West Bank settlement outpost. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Settler spokesman Yehoshua Mor Yosef said in a statement that Israeli bulldozers have begun removing empty mobile homes at the Neve Erez South outpost near the West Bank city of Ramallah. The Israeli army had no immediate comment. Neve Erez is on a list of 15 outposts that are scheduled to be dismantled, four of them populated. The U.S.-backed Roadmap to Peace calls on Israel to remove all settlement outposts built since March 2001. A Jewish settler leader said that for every outpost the army evacuates, the settlers will return the next day to occupy 10 more hilltop sites. Meanwhile, a new poll released today found a majority of Israelis support removing large numbers of settlements as part of a future peace agreement. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The Supreme Court has allowed Vietnam veterans to continue lawsuits against chemical companies over Agent Orange exposure during the Vietnam War. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
A 1984 settlement of Agent Orange claims provided for $180 million to be paid to affected Vietnam vets and imposed a 1994 deadline for claims, meaning that nobody who got sick after 1994 would qualify for payment. Some 50,000 veterans were compensated, but as it turned out, the effects of the chemical took longer than had been thought to produce cancer in many vets, and they sued after 1994, claiming they'd been wrongly shut out of the settlement. So in essence, the question before the Supreme Court was whether new lawsuits could be brought against the chemical manufacturers. Today, the High Court deadlocked 4-4 on that question, meaning that the lower court decision stands, allowing new lawsuits. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 83 points to close at 8,980 in heavy trading. Declining issues led advances by 2-1. The Nasdaq lost 23 points, or 1.4%, to close at 1,603. This is NPR News. A team of international experts has completed a review of Canada's investigation into a lone case of mad cow disease. Even though there was praise for the Canadian probe, U.S. officials won't speculate on when the border will be reopened to Canadian beef. Dan Karpinchuk reports from Toronto.
The experts came from the U.S., New Zealand, and Europe. One of the Europeans, Dr. Ulrich Kim, was satisfied with the work done in Canada.
According to our experience worldwide, I have never seen such a comprehensive investigation done in a short time.
At present, beef products are not used in cattle feed, but chicken and pork are allowed. Kim says one recommendation he and other experts made is to stop the use of all animal products in livestock feed. The Canadian investigation, now drawing to a close, found no other cases of mad cow disease. Talks will soon begin with the U.S., but the Americans say they need to examine Canada's scientific evidence before any decision is taken on when Canadian beef can resume crossing the border. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
North Korea threatened today to develop nuclear weapons as a deterrent to what it says is a hostile U.S. policy. It was the North Korean government's first public acknowledgement that it has plans to build nuclear weapons, although U.S. negotiators have said North Korean officials have told them privately that they already have such weapons. The statement from North Korea said it wanted a nuclear deterrent so that it could free up resources and personnel from its military and use them to improve the lives of its people. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said the North Korean statement shows that the North Korean government was neglecting and starving its own people. In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 12 points to close at 975. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovoSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Stefan Bognar, is an animal care specialist who spent 6 weeks in Baghdad helping to rebuild the Baghdad Zoo and caring for the remaining animals. Only about 7 of the 600 zoo animals remained when he arrived in Baghdad. The zoo was in disastrous condition. It had been a battle zone in which Saddam Hussein's troops had dug trenches. Some of the infrastructure was destroyed by shelling. The looters made off with what was left. They stripped the electrical wires, the irrigation systems, the cage bars, the doors, windows, and even toilet covers. Bognar works with WildAid, an international group based in San Francisco, whose mission is to stop the illegal trade in wildlife. When Bognar got to Baghdad, there were some wild animals wandering the streets. The military found a baboon and returned it to the zoo. I asked him what happened to some of the other zoo animals.
Because it was a major battle zone, some of the enclosures were ripped open, and some of the animals escaped. And because of the looters, some of the looters took the animals. We assume that either the animals were taken, probably some of the birds for consumption or to be used as exotic pets or to be sold in the black market. There are two black markets that operate in Baghdad. If you get there at 7:30 in the morning, you can get the good animals. But you can get, it's illegal. There are wildlife laws in Iraq, and it's illegal to sell Iraqi brown bears. It's illegal to sell eagles. It's illegal to sell hyenas. But surely these are animals that you can purchase out on the black market.
Were there animals that you personally rescued?
Well, we actually brought back a lot of Uday's personal collection. Uday had two sets of animals.
This is Uday Hussein, one of Saddam Hussein's sons.
That's correct. That is correct. And he loved large cats. Absolutely just loved large cats. We rescued two cheetahs, 5 lion cubs about 1 year old, and 2 lion cubs about 4 months old. And we brought the first set back to the Baghdad Zoo for care and for maintenance. The second set remained at one of his palaces, and the Special Forces, Unit Number 5, asked me to take care of these lions, to take care of these lions throughout my stay in Baghdad. And they actually named the lions. Brutus was the male lion, Zena and Heather. They named them after old former girlfriends. And Zena, when I was there, gave birth to 6 cubs. So all of a sudden, we had 3 large cats and 6 new cubs to deal with. And I have to let you know that each large cat requires over 5 kilos, over 10 pounds of meat a day. So it's one of the challenges that we had was to secure a food supply for these large cats. I mean, now we had Uday's 3 large cats at his palace, and then we had all these large cats at the Baghdad Zoo. So we had over 19 cats to feed, which is quite costly. You know, there are not too many zoos in the world that have 19 large cats.
Where did you find enough meat? I mean, people were having trouble finding food.
When I arrived in Baghdad, I went via Amman, and in Amman I bought about maybe 57 kilos worth of meat, and that was just for one day. So when I arrived in Baghdad, I immediately brought the meat to the animals and was able to feed them. And then it was daily trips to the market. I would go and try to find bones. I would try to go find meat. And you were able to find meat. Believe it or not, you were able to find frozen meat or buffalo meat from India, and you were able to find local meat as well. So it was daily trips to the market to purchase the food, to feed the animals. So that was a daily task, and it was quite challenging to do that every day.
Now, I read that you had to buy 4 donkeys on the black market to feed the lions?
That's correct. It's inexpensive to buy a donkey. It's about maybe $4 to buy a donkey. And we needed to procure donkeys to feed our cats. So yeah, so you know, we'd have to travel approximately about 60 miles outside the city to get donkeys to feed our animals. Some people obviously don't like to hear that, but it was a necessity. It was a requirement. We had to feed these animals. These animals were captured and brought to the zoo. It's our responsibility to take care of them.
Could you also argue, though, that, you know, why should you sacrifice the donkeys for the large cats?
What we were doing also, when I arrived in Baghdad and when I went to work with the Baghdad Zoo, my mission was not only to save the animals, but was also to work with the people. So when I arrived and fed the animals, I reached out to the zoo manager there with the lead veterinarian and a South African, Lawrence Anthony. And I said, well, we need to get all the employees back at the zoo. So let's offer them supplementary salaries. Let's reach out to them. Let's start giving them some money. And by the fourth day, about 95% of all the employees came back to work because they heard, oh, here's a foreign organization, and they're providing salaries. They're providing money. So naturally, all the employees came back to work. So now they're receiving supplementary salaries. They're receiving meals. I'm going out to buy the cleaning supplies and teaching them how to start taking care of the animals. They lack basic animal husbandry techniques in Iraq. You can be a vet, but animal husbandry techniques do not exist. They have a trouble bonding with the animals. An animal is supposed to be put in a cage, concrete floor, bars, looked at, fed, and that's it. There's no bonding with the animals. They have trouble touching them. So, you know, here I am and trying to teach them basic animal husbandry techniques, practices to reach out to the animal. Just not let's feed them, let's take care of these animals. So I was working with both. I was trying to implement a system with the personnel and also working with the animals. But I must say it's more challenging working with people, and especially individuals that, you know, are used to the regime, an ancient regime, and we had to try to bring them into a new system. You know, accountability, responsibility, transparency, all these concepts that, you know, they had no idea what we're trying to do, but daily, you know, for 5 weeks, they started to understand, well, this is performance. We want them to work. We're looking at results. We want them to reach out to the animals.
The animals that are still in the zoo or that were recaptured and taken back to the zoo, were they traumatized by the bombing?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And especially we do have three ostriches at the Baghdad Zoo. And you can see, the wing, you know, one of the wings broken, the legs, you can tell these animals were traumatized. Even the lions and the tigers, you can just see in their face and their behavior, their mannerisms. You can see they were traumatized. But I think the biggest thing was that they were all starving. So once you start feeding them and you start, you know, cleaning their cages, and you already start seeing a change in their behavior. So that was a priority, was definitely to start feeding them. When I walked in, I couldn't believe the cages, absolute filth. I mean, just filth everywhere, feces on the wall. It was quite disgusting. It was a disastrous situation.
I guess cleaning it wasn't very pleasant.
No, but it had to be done. And it's interesting, I actually had to start showing the employees how to really scrub a cage. We received, like I said, all of our employees came back to work, but we did have some exceptions. Our gardener, for instance, I found out that our gardener, who is now one of the zookeepers, was a former Iraqi soldier who had defected and became our gardener. So we'd have interesting stories like this.
Were there security precautions you had to take about who was on the staff?
No. I mean, because we had our zoo manager and we had the lead veterinarian, and they helped us identify all the personnel, and they all did come back. The security that we had, like I said, was making sure that the looters weren't coming to the zoo every day and stripping it or taking the animals. And the zoo was located in what the army called the green zone. There are two zones in Baghdad, the red zone and the green zone. The green zone is everything that's basically cordoned off by the army. That's because the Office for Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance is located into this green zone. And the zoo happens to be into this green zone. So that's why the zoo is still closed and is heavily guarded. But there are still a lot of looters that can manage, you know, that manage actually to get onto the zoo grounds, because such a large zoo is one of the largest in the Middle East.
The museums weren't secured by the U.S. military during and after the war, and consequently, great treasures were looted. Yes. Immediately after the war. What about the zoo? At what point was it secured by the military?
Well, after the major battle took place, the zoo fell into the green zone. So just because of its location in the green zone, it was going to be protected by the U.S. military. Unfortunately, the museum was in the red zone. So that's why right after the war, it wasn't secured immediately after. But the zoo, don't get me wrong, like I said, there were a lot of looters getting into the zoo back and forth, but it is in the green zone, so it has a little more protection just because of the very nature of its location.
Now, you've said that you think Iraqis don't really understand much about animal husbandry. Are pets popular in Iraq?
Very good question. I learned that, the answer is no. And I saw that because my first reaction when I saw that some of the Iraqis didn't want, or even our local staff didn't want to touch the dogs. And it was explained to me that animals are seen as dirty creatures. And because they have to pray five times during the day, that if they touch an animal, you know, therefore they can't pray, and they must be clean before they go pray. So no, amongst the Arab Muslim community, animals or pets are not popular. So amongst the Christians, though, which I found that a lot of Christian Arabs in Iraq have dogs, have pets. And I also found out from seeing with the zoo manager and our personnel that they themselves were looked, you know, they were frowned upon because they worked at the zoo and because they had to touch animals, and it was reflected in their salaries. I think they received, I think it was quoted, $3 to $4 a month. That was their salary.
What's the most amazing adventure with an animal that you had during your stay in Iraq?
Because I was responsible for Uday's personal collection, or the Special Forces collection at Uday's Palace, I had to go there daily to bond with Brutus and Zine and Heather, and I started to watch the cubs grow. And I was the first person to actually hold these cubs because the mothers recognized my scent since I was there daily. Just holding these cubs, you know, it's interesting that here's death and destruction all around, and all of a sudden we have six new living creatures brought into this world, and bonding with them and seeing them grow was quite a magical or spiritual experience for me. It was real relief to be there, and sometimes I would just spend 45 minutes there and just sitting on the ground, and in the background you're listening to the mortar shells or the gunfires. So it was really a nice break to be there, because I was there about 6 weeks, so it was quite peaceful to be in that environment with the six cubs.
My guest is Stefan Bognar, a field agent with the group Wild Aid. We'll talk more about his work rebuilding the Baghdad Zoo after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stefan Bognar, a field agent with the group Wild Aid. He returned last week from Baghdad, where he spent about 6 weeks helping to rebuild the zoo and care for the remaining animals. In addition to your adventures with animals, did you have any run-ins with militias or, you know, other people with guns?
Yeah, actually, I think it was the first day I arrived and I found myself on the ground, and there was an exchange of gunfire. And some of the bullets hit trees, and then the bark actually went into my eyes and actually paralyzed my eyelid for about a week and a half.
Piece of bark from the tree went into
your eyes? Because the exchange of gunfire. Just, you know, Terry, listening and feeling the whizzing of a bullet over your head, I can't describe that feeling. But I now know what it feels like. I know I can actually detect that sound. It's still very... I can still remember exactly that sound over my head. That was one situation. And another situation, I was walking. There are curfews. And again, I lived in the red zone. So you had to be in usually before dark. And I was walking home. I was walking back to my hotel. And right in front of me, two Iraqis were gunned down. And the only thing I remember is just seeing these two guys just falling right to the ground. And someone, I think it was an American soldier, said, you know, get out of there. And you freeze. You know, what do you do? I mean, your first year, you know, you want to help out, you want to reach out. I remember I was driving, going to the market, and my transit was in the back, and my driver's trying to push me on the ground of the car and are yelling, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And I look right in front of us. There was a carjacking where these two guys jumped on the back of the truck, and one guy opened the door with three machine guns. And just, you know, I'm staring at the guy's face and just are just dragging him out. So, yeah, I still have fresh memories of my experience with these militias in Baghdad. Security was an issue. Definitely security was an issue. The American forces, there were not enough soldiers to patrol the streets to ensure security. And that was the biggest complaint from Iraqis, is that they did not feel safe and secure to go to the markets, to get, you know, to send their kids to school. I mean, security was an issue.
Were you wearing anything that would identify you to the people of Baghdad as being an aid worker and not a member of the military or, you know?
Well, because I went to Baghdad Zoo with one pair of pants, two T-shirts, a pair of boots, a couple pair of socks. That was it for 6 weeks. So I was a civilian and I looked like a civilian. But because I only had one pair of pants, that when I was working at the Baghdad Zoo, actually I was wearing military fatigues and I had a Special Forces T-shirt that I was wearing. But every time I left the compound, I definitely made sure that I had my regular pair of pants I wanted, because I was the guy working, going to get the food, going to get the meat, working, you know, trying to get these engineers to come and fix the zoo. I wanted them to see me as a civilian, not as, you know, some soldier. And I didn't want to, and although I was shot at several times, I did not want to bring more attention to me by wearing, you know, military fatigues every day, especially, you know, in the red zone.
I bet you've gotten both praise and criticism for the work you've done at the Baghdad Zoo. Praise for helping to rescue animals who were kind of in the crossfire of this war. But maybe criticism for spending the time and energy on the animals when so many people are suffering. Did you get it from both sides?
Absolutely. Not only did I come under fire from the militias, but absolutely. The real fire came from the humanitarian organizations that were working in Baghdad. There are two things I'd like to say on that. Again, because of our policy, our program called Surviving Together, WildAid works with both communities. And I definitely, you know, we were there, not only work with the animals, but we were there providing meals to all the employees, providing them supplementary salaries, coaching them, working with them. They weren't out on the streets, you know, shooting themselves or attacking. They were there working. Interestingly, I have to say this, is that throughout my stay in Baghdad, you had all these humanitarian organizations, Terry. A majority of these organizations were doing assessments. So they would spend days and days going to hospitals or wherever doing assessments, a lot of paperwork. And we're not providing any media assistance. So a lot of these organizations were going there without even any funds. So my response was, so you've just done a complete assessment at one of the hospitals. So after you've done this assessment, have you gone out? Have you gone to procure sheets or blankets or pillows or clothing or food? The answer was no, we're just here to do these assessments. Well, you know, that's fine, but you in such a situation, you need to reach out to the people right away. You need to make a difference today. You just can't keep waiting. So when I went, you know, when we went to the zoo, it's like we had the funds with us. We made it, you know, it was a quick assessment, quick decision. Let's go there. Let's provide immediate assistance. People have to see tangible results. That's why at the Baghdad Zoo, we had in the press releases, we had seen so many organizations, oh, they're already in Baghdad working with the Baghdad Zoo. That wasn't the case. That wasn't reality. They were waiting to go into Baghdad before they felt, you know, safe enough to get in. When I was there, it was like, it's me. And that's the situation. That was reality. You know, when I left, it was heartbreaking to say goodbye to the staff. The people our staff didn't want to see me leave. We formed one, and they clearly saw. They kept on saying, you know, you guys are the really true assessors. You're here to work with us, with the people. Absolutely. You know, I reached out to the communities when we started to repair the line enclosures. We could have relied on the military to, you know, they have their welders at the Civil Air Department, and we did. But I made sure to tell them that, no, we need to go to the community and hire some of these guys who know how to build these things. We need to reach out to the community to together build this.
You had a hard time getting out of Baghdad. What was the problem?
Correct. There are two ways to get out of Baghdad. Either you're going to get a military plane to get you to Kuwait, or you're going to take a convoy to Amman, and then you fly home. And because I had all my possessions in Israel, I was working on a project. Prior to my arrival in Baghdad, I was working on a project. I was trying to recruit agricultural specialists to take him back to Cambodia, where we're working on a community development program. I had to go, I had to go via, you know, I had to go with a convoy to Amman, and that's like a 14-hour trek through the desert. When I say a convoy, how it works is you, there are four GMCs. They're like, do you know what a GMC is? Like large SUVs. And you go in packs of four to ensure security, because what happened is that after the war, there were hardly any soldiers protecting this road going from Baghdad to Amman. So you had a lot of thieves or Alibabas that were setting up these false roadblocks. And so you think it's a checkpoint, but it's not, and that's where they attack you. So when I left, there were two convoys ahead of me that were attacked. Thank goodness I wasn't attacked. Well, but it's a 14-hour trek through the desert. And then when I finally got to Israel, to the border, the back checkpoint, they actually detained me for over 7 hours and questioned me at different angles, different people. And the assumption was that I was a possible spy, because what was I doing in Baghdad? What was I doing in Amman? How could you be working with the Baghdad Zoo? I mean, they couldn't grasp the concept. Even though I had papers from the State Department that I was working at the Baghdad Zoo, it was beyond their understanding that here's a guy coming from Baghdad. He has to be, you know, I'm sure he's some sort of spy. So they detained me. And after answering questions for over 7 hours from different angles, you almost break down. You say, okay, what do you want? I'll tell you anything you want. I'll just I need to get out of here. So it was quite an ordeal just to get out of Baghdad. And when I got out of Baghdad, it was another ordeal. So it didn't end there. The adventure continued.
And now you're in San Francisco, which is where Wild Aid is headquartered?
That's correct. Wild Aid is headquartered in San Francisco. So I've come back to San Francisco to regroup, gain some weight back, start working with my staff again, and start. I will be going back to Baghdad in about a month and a half to make sure that all of our, because right now we've collected quite a bit of money, and we are going to be distributing this money. We're actually working with the American Zoo and Aquarium Association to channel this money through them to make sure that they're going to start rebuilding the zoo.
So what's the future of the Baghdad Zoo looking like? Is it going to be ready to open the public anytime in the near future?
I don't think so. And that's because the zoo is located in the green zone. And again, that's the cordoned off area. So right now it's shut to the public, and I don't think it's going to be open for at least a few more months. There's a big debate now on what we're going to do with all these large cats. And we do have permission now. We finally have permission from the administration that we can actually take some of these large cats and give them some foreign passports. And we think we're going to bring actually some of them to South Africa.
Well, thank you so much. Good luck in your travels.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Stefan Bognar is a field agent for the group Wild Aid, which is based in San Francisco. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Lost in Translation, a novel about an American woman experiencing Beijing for the first time by Nicole Moniz, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet jazz pianist and singer Barbara Carroll. She recently received a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Kennedy Center. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the Buddy Emmons reissue Steel Guitar Jazz. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the modern fixation with acronyms. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Whether you're listening to NPR on AM or FM, whether you're in a BMW or an SUV, or just on the MTA, there's no way to get around the modern fixation for forming words out of strings of initials. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has these thoughts on the first appearance of the word acronym 60 years ago.
TLAMs and RPGs, MREs and SSEs, EPWs and WMDs. The language we were hearing from the Iraq War had a decidedly alphabetic ring. But then, that's only appropriate. The word acronym itself was first used 60 years ago to describe military coinings like WAC, ANZAC, and radar, all drawn from the initials of longer phrases. By 1942, the process was familiar enough so that servicemen could make fun of it with the term SNAFU, for situation normal, all fouled up. Well, fouled is only an approximation. Of course, the American fondness for acronyms and abbreviations began well before World War II. After all, ours was the first modern nation to be known by its initials. 19th century Americans gave the language items like COD, SOB, and PDQ. And that's not to mention OK, which is certainly the most successful American contribution to the languages of the world, even if nobody's sure what the letters originally stood for. But it wasn't until the mid-20th century that acronyms became the linguistic wallpaper of modern life. One of the most successful acronyms of the 50s was VEEP, which was used affectionately for Truman's Vice President Alvin Barkley. It was largely abandoned in 1953 when Richard Nixon took over the job and made it known that he didn't like the appellation. Nixon wasn't a man to whom the phrase lighten up had a lot of meaning. But the Republican administration compensated by introducing other acronyms like RIF for reduction in force. That was the first bureaucratic euphemism for layoffs, and as it turns out, a surprisingly resilient one. Some sticklers insist that the word acronym should only be used for a string of letters that's pronounced as a word, like RIF or like NATO. Items like FBI and LSD, they call initialisms. I suppose that's a valid distinction, but most people can't be bothered with it. And anyway, it misses the main point. However they're pronounced, the crucial thing about these expressions is the way they come to live lives of their own as separate words. AC in a real estate classified is just an abbreviation for air conditioning. But ACDC is a distinct word when it's used to describe a sexual orientation. I mean, if you heard somebody's sexuality described as alternating current, direct current, your thoughts would run in a very different direction. And you may have your doubts about UFOs, but nobody denies the existence of unidentified flying objects. It's astonishing how pervasive these coinings have become over the past 60 years. I'm not thinking just of the ones that come from bureaucracy and technology. Those are mostly used for efficiency. Strings like SEC and EEG flow a lot more trippingly from the tongue than Securities and Exchange Commission and electroencephalogram. But by now, acronyms are piled up in every room in the American house. BLTs, PB&J, and OJ in the kitchen, GTOs, RVs, and SUVs in the garage, and TP in the bathroom, provided that somebody remembered to stop at the A&P. In the living room, we turn on the VCR or put on a CD by REM, ELO, or UB40. In the bedroom, we slip out of our BVDs and cop some Zs. Yuppies and WASPs, LSD and PCP, TGIF and BYOB, CBGBs and MTV, you could sketch the whole social history of the post-war period just by listing the initials it's carved on the walls. Items like these don't have much to do with a propensity for conciseness. In fact, most of them barely save any syllables over their spelled-out equivalents. The urge to acronymize goes deeper than that. It's as if we're moving toward a purely analytic language where the shape of every word reveals its meaning to the initiates who possess the secret key. In that sense, acronyms are the slang of a textual world. There's a mysterious sense of destiny to these names. The Kabbalist used the process called notaricon to form new names for God by combining the first or last letters from phrases or biblical verses. And the Tudors studded their verses with acronyms and acrostics, though probably not nearly so many as scholars have claimed to find in their efforts to prove that Shakespeare's works were written by somebody else. That's the same impulse that leads people to rig the game. They start with a plausible acronym and then contrive a description to fit it. As best I can tell, the first of these was WAVES, the name the Navy coined in 1942 for women accepted for volunteer emergency service. And in later years, The same process has given us organizational names like CARE, NOW, and MAD. Nobody's more adept at this than legislators. Over the past few years, we've had the RAVE Act for reducing Americans' vulnerability to ecstasy and Operation TIPS, the Terrorism Information and Prevention System. And then there's the Anti-Terrorism Act that goes by the name of Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism. That acronymizes as USA Patriot, a happy accident indeed.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University's Center for the Study of Language and Information, and he's the author of the book The Way We Talk Now. Coming up, pianist and singer Barbara Carroll. This is Fresh Air. Pianist Barbara Carroll started recording in the late 1940s, when a woman jazz musician was still considered quite a novelty. Last month at the Kennedy Center's Women in Jazz Festival, she received the Lifetime Achievement Award. We're listening to her play Thelonious Monk's In Walked Bud from her latest album, One Morning in May. Barbara Carroll also sings. For 24 years, she played and sang at the Carlyle Hotel in Manhattan, the hotel that has also been home to Bobby Short. On most of Carroll's recordings, she sings on a few tracks. Here's another track from One Morning in May.
Here we are at last. It's like a dream. The two of us. A perfect team. It's an awful pity we never met before.
Barbara Carroll, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. I'm very happy to be with you today.
You started performing at a time when there were very few women jazz musicians, or at least successful ones. How did you feel about always being referred to as, like, the lady pianist? I imagine you were thought of as almost like a novelty act because you were a woman.
Well, you put it very nicely. You're saying the lady pianist. Actually, what people would say when they were giving you the ultimate compliment was, gee, you play good for a girl, or... worse still, you play just like a man. You know, so when I was growing up, those were the accolades that one got.
Now, you sing as well as play piano, but on your records, you usually just sing a few tracks on each recording. Were you ever afraid, particularly when you were getting started, that if you sang too much, you would be thought of as a singer and not so much as a pianist, and it would take away from your reputation as an instrumentalist? You'd be, regarded as like another girl singer.
Well, actually, I must confess, Terry, it wasn't that. I was afraid to sing, not because they'd think that I was a singer, because they'd think I wasn't a singer. And I always knew a lot of lyrics. I knew the lyrics to everything that I played. I had a sister who was really crazy about all the good songs, and she knew the lyrics to everything. She had a voice that was, not terribly attractive sometimes, but that didn't keep her from singing. So she used to sing everything. I learned all the words to everything. But I was always afraid to sing because I didn't think I had the voice. I didn't think I had the range. I was totally insecure about it. And today I don't think of myself as a singer either. I think of myself as a pianist who sings. And I have come to the conclusion that the important thing when you're singing is to tell the story. And I console myself with that, you see. I'm telling the story. And I love to sing. But essentially, my first love is playing the piano.
Do you remember the first time you actually sang in public?
I sang a little bit on my RCA recordings, which were some of the first records I made in the 1950s. And then when I began playing at the Carlisle, I was just playing the piano, and then people would always say, oh, sing it. You know, they'd hear a certain song that they loved, and they'd sing it, you know. And so I would sing it. And little by little, I gained some confidence in singing. And it's a great joy to sing.
Well, you mentioned that you sang a few tracks on some of your very early records. Why don't we hear one of those? And this is from your 1956 recording, It's a Wonderful World. And we'll hear At Long Last Love, in which you're featured at the piano and on vocals.
Is it an earthquake or is it a shock? Is this the good turtle soup or merely the mock? Is it a cocktail, this feeling of joy? Or is what I feel the real McCoy? Is this for all time or merely a lark? Is it Granada I see or only Asbury Park? Is this a fancy not worth dreaming of? Or is it at long last love?
That's Barbara Carroll, piano and vocals, recorded in 1956 from her album It's a Wonderful World. You know, it's interesting, you said you were never trained as a singer and, you know, you were very shy about your singing, you didn't think you were very good. You were trained as a pianist, you studied piano from the time you were a girl, you went to the New England Conservatory of Music. Did you, in that sense, think of your singing and your piano playing as mismatched because you were so untrained as a singer?
No. You see, I began playing the piano when I was about 4 or 5 years old. I had two older sisters who had been given piano lessons and violin lessons and all kinds of lessons, but they didn't want to practice and they weren't really interested in playing. And I was about 10 years younger than my middle sister. I was the youngest in the family. And by the time I came along, my parents were rather disenchanted with the idea of going for all that money for the piano lessons again because, you know, they had had bad experiences with my two sisters. So I was playing when I was 5 and 6, and I really wanted to study. And I finally prevailed upon them to let me study classical music, which I began studying when I was 8 years old. I studied classical music until I was about 15 in Worcester, and then, as I say, I went to the conservatory for a little bit. I didn't feel, your question was, did I feel mismatched because I had formal training in playing the piano and I had not in singing? No, in jazz, actually, I don't know that you have to have formal training in singing. I'm sure it might help, but I'm sure that many of the great jazz singers did not have that formal training.
I think most did not.
And I would say that, yes, absolutely. And as far as formal training in playing the piano, I certainly think it's helpful in giving you the ability, the technique, the technical ability to play the piano and play whatever you want, because if you have the technique, you can go ahead and play jazz or play whatever, whatever comes to mind.
How were you first exposed to jazz?
Well, when I was in Worcester, I used to hear the radio, listen to the radio a lot, and they were live. You know, in those days, there were remote broadcasts, that's what they called them, which meant they were live performances from jazz rooms, from hotels, from places where there were bands and there were instrumentalists playing wonderful jazz music, and that's what I heard when I was in Worcester. And then I heard Nat King Cole and his trio, and that was as if a light went on for me, because Nat Cole was my very first favorite pianist. He was a marvelous pianist. A lot of people remember him as a great singer, which of course he was, but for me, he was the excitement about playing jazz piano. And then after that, I heard Art Tatum, and later on, Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell and Oscar Peterson, et cetera, et cetera. But it was Nat Cole first.
In 1957, I know you were playing in a trio with your husband, the bass player Joe Shulman. This was your first husband, your late husband. And was that helpful, having a husband who was also a jazz musician? And here's what I'm thinking. Because a lot of men in general and jazz musicians in particular in this instance might have thought of you as like an available woman, you know, like a chick who plays, but we know what she really wants. it could have really kind of interfered with your ability to just play and not be misinterpreted, if you know what I mean. So like if your husband's there, then like, okay, you're no longer, quote, available. So you're just like a piano player. You're just there for professional reasons. No one could misinterpret that. Was that helpful?
I don't know if it was helpful or not helpful. I only know that we had a really wonderful marriage. He was an extraordinary musician, and we had a marriage that was unusual because we worked together, and we were together all the time. So it was really quite wonderful. Unfortunately, Joe died when he was 33 years old. We had only been married for 3 years. And he had a heart attack.
That's so young.
Suddenly, we were on Fire Island. We had taken the summer off because we were working so much, and we just wanted a little downtime. And just out of the blue, this happened.
Was it hard to get back to work after he died? I mean, to resume your life?
Yes, after he died, it was very difficult because I wanted to work. I wanted to go back to work. But you see, I was working with a trio, and I needed a bass player. And so I had to audition bass players, and that was extremely difficult because nobody played as well as he, and, of course, nobody could fill his shoes in any way. So it took a long time. But it didn't take a long time to get back to work. I went back to work rather quickly. It took a very long time to get over that.
Right. A question about clothing for you. On your latest recording, One Morning in May, you're wearing a black turtleneck sweater and you're seated at the piano. On your recordings from the 1950s, or at least the couple that I have with me, you're wearing more like, you know, a cocktail dress or an evening gown, something with straps that, you know, with bare shoulders, you know, that. So what was expected of you in terms of your image in the 1950s when you were one of the few women pianists recording?
Exactly what you said. Bare shoulders, cocktail dress, you know, a little cleavage if you were fortunate enough to have it. and that's the way it was. You know, I look at old photographs of myself, professional photographs that were taken during that time in the 1950s, and they're all very sultry and glamorous. There were photographers at that time like Maurice Seymour and James Kriegsman and Bruno of Hollywood. And they took these marvelous pictures with lighting and shadows and, you know, just made you look terrific. And it was all glamour, and it was wonderful. Things have changed, though. You know, I don't dress that way now. I don't wear things that are bare-shouldered and cut out. I'm more casual, in keeping, I think, with the spirit of the times.
In speaking of the glamour photos, on your album We Just Couldn't Say Goodbye, which is from the 1950s, you're at the piano wearing this, you know, a cocktail dress with straps, with the cleavage and the bare shoulders. And there's three men in suits with their elbows on the piano, listening intently and staring at you admiringly.
Well, I'm glad you said staring at me admiringly. Actually, what happened was that they needed a cover photograph, and somebody at RCA, Victor got the great idea, you know, let's get a couple of guys standing around the piano looking at Barbara while she's playing. So they called in some of the fellows who were in the corridor there. And they say, would you fellas please come in and look at Barbara admiringly? That's what happened.
That's really funny. And how did you feel about the cover, about the album photo?
I wasn't crazy about it. because I always remembered the circumstances under which it happened, you know. But that was the idea. Whether that feeling came through, or whether that translated on the cover, I'm not sure. They were supposed to be overwhelmed with what I was playing. I'm not sure that that is the expression that they had.
Well, Barbara Carroll, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Barbara Carroll's latest CD is called One Morning in May. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of the Buddy Emmons album Steel Guitar Jazz. This is Fresh Air. The sliding sound of steel guitar originated in Hawaii and spread to the mainland 100 years ago. The modern pedal steel guitar is a signature sound of country music and is heard in black Pentecostal churches, in Nigerian juju bands, and on Bollywood soundtracks from India. But this almost universally useful instrument has made few inroads into jazz. Critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue from 1963 that tried to fix that.
Buddy Emmons on pedal steel guitar with Jerome Richardson on tenor sax. Emmons hails from Indiana, where he studied Hawaiian guitar before turning pro in his teens. In 1963, at age 26, he went to New York to record the quintet LP, Steel Guitar Jazz, with a solid rhythm section including drummer Charlie Persip and sometime Coltrane bassist Art Davis. This is a welcome reissue, not because it's always great, but because there's so little like it. Silver. Some early recording artists we now stamp as country and western saw themselves as jazz musicians, like Bob Wills of the Texas Playboys. Western swing hotshot Bob Dunn dreamed of making steel guitar a jazz instrument, and the modern steel, with pedals to change a string's pitch, was developed to bring fancier, jazzier chords within reach. ¶¶ Country musicians loved jazz's easy swing, but their concept of jazz harmony often needed an update. And when Buddy Emmons plays something like a hip modern jazz lick, he can lean on it like a joke, as if it's hard to take seriously. It's an odd case of the ironic outsider clashing with earnest New Yorkers. He was ready for him. Here's Emmons on the jazz test piece, Cherokee. That works, but Buddy Emmons and his jazz pals don't always mesh quite so well. Still, everyone tries to get along. Sometimes, pianist Bobby Scott tosses in some rippling Floyd Kramer country licks, which themselves mimic a steel guitar slide up several notes. The Steel Guitar Jazz album didn't make Buddy Emmons a jazz contender, but he's done all right. Also in 63, he joined singer Ray Price for 5 years, and he went on to play on lots of country and pop records. Later, he recorded with jazz guitarist Lenny Bro and made a batch of albums with the word swing in the title, playing country standards and jazz goldies like Perdido and Take the A-Train. Buddy Emmons never gave up on jazz, even if he didn't pick up the New York accent.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the Internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, what Saddam Hussein has in common with Tony Soprano. We talk with journalist Tom Ricks. He just spent 3 weeks in Iraq, observing U.S. troops charged with keeping the peace. Ricks covers the military for The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.